This is VOA News, via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Democratic-led efforts to impeach U.S. President Donald Trump for a second time are the talk of Washington this weekend, although it looked uncertain whether enough Republicans would back the move with just days left in his presidential term. President-elect Joe Biden takes the oath of office on January 20th, officially becoming the President of the United States. Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives, nevertheless, will introduce articles of impeachment this week. The move comes after Trump stirred up his supporters on Wednesday, and they later stormed the U.S. Capitol. Five people died in the melee. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence will attend President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, a senior administration official said this weekend. On Friday, President Trump said he would not attend the inauguration of his successor, which takes place a week from Wednesday. And Georgia's newly elected Democratic senator, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, took to the pulpit Sunday at Atlanta's famed Ebenezer Baptist Church, just as he has for the past 15 years. But this time he spoke as an incoming U.S. Congress member and the first Black U.S. senator from Georgia. This is the church where civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. once preached. Indonesian authorities on Sunday located the black boxes of the jet that crashed into the sea soon after taking off from the capital, Jakarta, as human body parts and pieces of the plane were also retrieved. The Boeing 737-500 with 62 passengers and crew was headed on a domestic flight to Borneo Saturday before it disappeared from radar screens 4 minutes after taking off. For more on these and other stories making international news, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. A Hong Kong website that publishes material mainly related to anti-government protests in 2019 said its users' access had been blocked by the city's internet service providers, or ISPs. The website, HK Chronicle, said it began receiving reports from Hong Kong-based users saying they were no longer able to access the site as of late Wednesday. Editor Naomi Chan said in a statement, quote, "After discussing and investigating with our supporters, we found that some ISPs of Hong Kong have deliberately dropped any connection to our servers so that the user could not receive replies from our servers, resulting in an inability to access our content," end quote. The South China Morning Post newspaper, citing unnamed sources, said Sunday that Hong Kong police had invoked the city's national security law for the first time to block HK Chronicles. The Hong Kong and Beijing governments say it's vital to plug holes in national security defenses exposed by months of sometimes violent anti-government and anti-China protests that rocked the global financial hub in 2019. Hong Kong police arrested 53 people in dawn raids on democracy activists on Wednesday, in the biggest crackdown since China imposed the security law last year. Apple and Amazon have both suspended the social media network Parler from their respective app store and web hosting service, saying the social networking service, popular with many far right-wing users, has not taken adequate measures to prevent the spread of posts inciting violence. The action by Apple and Amazon follows a similar move by Google on Friday. Parler is favored by many supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump, who was permanently suspended from Twitter on Friday. It's seen as a haven for people who have been expelled from Twitter. In a post on the site, its chief executive said this was a coordinated attack by the tech giants to kill competition in the marketplace. He added that the platform had many options for moving ahead. Parler started in 2018 and was initially a home for the extreme right, but now it attracts more traditional conservative voices, including Republican lawmakers. And nationalist politician Sadr Japarov won a landslide victory on Sunday in Kyrgyzstan's snap presidential election. He's won almost 80% of the vote in the Central Asian nation, which is closely allied with Russia. Preliminary results cited by the Central Election Commission showed this. This means there will be no runoff. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this U.S. politics edition of the program, Democrats pick up two Senate seats, effectively giving them control of the upper chamber of Congress. The U.S. Congress certifies Democrat Joe Biden's win in the November presidential election after supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building in a violent attempt to derail the process. Members of both political parties condemned the attack on the symbol of the nation's democracy, which resulted in at least five deaths, scores of injured, and the destruction of federal property. Top Democrats have called for President Trump's removal from power via the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, which lays out the details of presidential succession, or through a second impeachment process for having spurred his supporters to aggressively contest his electoral loss. This is Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi denouncing President Trump's actions in a televised address on Thursday, January 7.
In calling for this seditious act, the president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the vice president to remove this president by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment. If the vice president and the cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Several Trump administration officials have resigned over the violence at the Capitol, including Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary, and Betsy DeVos, the education secretary. Well, for more on the ramifications of these and other critical issues at this time of political transition, we turn to our veteran analysts. John Fortier, formerly director of governmental studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, now resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, that's a prominent conservative think tank here in Washington, and Jim Kessler, executive vice president for policy at Third Way, that's a center-left policy group also based in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
And John, let me begin with you. I'd like to get your reaction to the violent assault on the Capitol, just as the joint session of Congress was doing what is normally considered a ceremonial count of the Electoral College votes, certified already by states which administer our national elections. What's your reaction?
Well, this is one of the most terrible, horrible days in Washington in recent memory. Any sort of violence is always to be condemned, but to add to it that it was directed at the Capitol, that people made it into the Capitol during a part of the end of the vote counting process through the Electoral College was just one of the worst things one could imagine. It also was precipitated by some terrible actions by Donald Trump in the days in December and January relating to extending the dispute over the election. Early on, of course, people have the right to challenge results in court. But one of the more egregious instances of the president pushing, for example, the Secretary of State of Georgia to change the election results. So a terrible set of circumstances, one that has very badly damaged Donald Trump and essentially sidelined him and changed the discourse, very badly damaged the Republican Party. And obviously, we knew we were going to have a Joe Biden presidency beginning January 20th. That still is the case. The Georgia races you mentioned, also Democrats with that will have, you know, a majority, a slim majority, but still a majority in the Senate going forward. And, you know, it's a very difficult time for the Republican Party. Certainly, Donald Trump has lost a lot of stature in the party, in the country, and his future is in grave doubt. But it was a terrible day that we hope to never see repeated.
Over to you, Jim Kessler. Following on what John said, even after the violence on January 6th, a handful of Republican senators led by Josh Hawley of Missouri and Ted Cruz of Texas and more than 100 Republican members of the House of Representatives still objected to the electoral count in an apparent effort to placate President Trump and his supporters. Now, of course, they didn't succeed, as we said, and as John said, the count was certified by the Congress and Joe Biden will be inaugurated on January 20. Nonetheless, what's your take on all of this?
Well, the actions on the day where the electoral vote were to be counted were disgraceful. Everyone is responsible for their own behavior, but the most responsibility belongs to Donald Trump. His actions since the election and claiming that the election was stolen is just a bold-faced lie. It's completely reprehensible. It is counter to what this country is all about. But nothing about Donald Trump surprises me. I guess I'm still continued to be surprised that so many Republican legislators who know better enable President Trump and continue down this folly, this perpetuating this lie. You talked about Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Josh Hawley, who were the lead, at least in the Senate, of challenging the Electoral College vote. I mean, look, I think that this is a combination of their own personal ambition, what they think will play in the future to a Republican voter who in some ways has been brainwashed by far-right media and Donald Trump, and with a dose of cowardice because they're afraid of a negative tweet from Donald Trump. And if you put together ambition and cowardice together and politicians in power, that's a very dangerous chemical reaction that can occur. And we just saw the worst of America this week.
Turning back to you, John Forty, now there's talk of punishment for what President Trump did. Many have criticized on both sides of the aisle his rhetoric, which incited the supporters to assault the Capitol. There's talk of impeachment in the 25th Amendment. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer said that Democrats now are prepared to impeach Trump for a second time. But many say that with less than 2 weeks until the end of the president's term, it's unclear whether Democrats could move quickly enough to do so. But they want to signal that this is wrong. Now, of course, we want to mention that there are many Republicans, or at least several. Adam Kinzinger, a representative from Illinois, a Republican, has been very outspoken against the president, what he has done. And even the National Association of Manufacturers, which is a conservative business group, have called for invoking the 25th Amendment. What's your take on these measures and whether or not they're even viable?
Look, the ground really shifted in dramatic ways after the incident in the Capitol, and the ground, especially for the support of Donald Trump. And Democrats were, of course, against Donald Trump, and even more so. But many, many Republicans came out pretty strongly against Donald Trump. We've had resignations in the cabinet, resignations in the White House. We certainly had some change in the way that electoral count vote went, with a number of Republicans backing down from their previous intention to object. So I think there's been some significant sea change. I think things are changing quickly, so it's a little hard to tell. But my sense is that we're not going to see the use of the 25th Amendment. I guess probably my constitutional sense says if you want to remove the president, impeachment is probably a stronger, more clear way to go. Just signals the more direct type of thing that you want to do, remove a president for certain abuses. But I also think even though the ground has shifted very significantly, that, you know, it's a mix of how it shifted on the Republican side. Many are not supportive of the president, but are also probably not supportive of going forward and removing the president when there's not much time left. I suspect that it could happen somewhat quickly, impeachment and removal, but it does take some time. Democrats, if they see now the 25th Amendment is probably not going to be invoked by the vice president, I believe are probably going to push forward with some impeachment attempt. And that might not take that long, but still will get us into next week. I guess I think at the end of the day, Republicans as a whole, or the number that would be required to do this, look like they're going to say, look, this might just add to the wounds. We're happy to let the term run out. We're not so happy with Donald Trump, but that not removing him in the last days looks like my sense of what is likely to happen. My sense is we'll probably see some movement on the Democratic side towards impeachment, but the term will run out with Donald Trump in a much worse position and many Republicans very unhappy. Happy with them.
Turning back to you, Jim Kessler, what do you make of the talk of impeachment? Is this more of an attempt to placate the Democratic base? Certainly, it's very serious because Democrats and Republicans are extremely upset. Where do you think this is going?
What I would like to see is articles of impeachment from the House that is deeply bipartisan. It is time for Republicans in the House and in the Congress to finally stand up. Enough is enough. Look, there's 12 days left in this administration. I think he'll succeed and be able to run out the clock. But there has to be some bipartisan signal in this country that the president's behavior is not acceptable. Look, on this show a few months ago, I said he is going to say the election is stolen from him because he basically announced it at the Republican convention. Nobody should be surprised about this. But it is time for, this is a time for choosing. And I'm not talking about impeachment because it's like the likelihood of removing him. I just think it's a, you know, there, like I said, there's only 12 days left. But it's time for Republicans to stand with the nation and not stand with him.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier, formerly Director of Governance Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, now resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jim Kessler, from whom you just heard, co-founder and Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. They join me via Microsoft Teams, and we are discussing the transition of power in Washington as the incoming Biden administration is set to control the executive and legislative levers of power as of January 20. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter follower, Mohammed Awal Inusa from Accra, Ghana. As always, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And tune in this weekend to our sister show, Press Conference USA. I talk with political scientist Frances E. Lee, who discusses her new book, The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. Lee tells VOA that divided government, that is, when one political party holds the executive branch and the other controls one or both chambers of Congress, can produce meaningful bipartisan legislation. Professor Lee also reacts to the Democrats' narrow control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives and what it means for President-elect Joe Biden's legislative agenda. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. And now back to Encounter with our political gurus, Jim Kessler and John Fortier. Well, back to you, John Fortier. And let's talk about the incoming administration, as well as those Senate races in Georgia, which turned out to be a boon for the Democrats, a narrow win for Raphael Warnock, the first Black senator from Georgia. And then a young Jewish fellow, John Ossoff, won his race to many people's surprise. What do you make of the new dynamic in the Senate, and what will it give the Biden administration, any kind of advantages?
Well, this was obviously very good news for Democrats. And look, I think there were a lot of reasons why those races went the way they did. One of them was because I think we were still fighting the 2020 election and people were still voting against Donald Trump. Often, and we may see this with the Biden administration, when a new administration comes in power, that administration doesn't do as well in midterm elections and runoffs. And this was clearly still the atmosphere of the 2020 election, with Democrats coming out very strongly. Other reasons too, changes in Georgia, strong Black support. But certainly I think that the fact that it was seen as a continuation of the election was a good reason for Democrats winning, and they did very well. As for the effects of this, I guess I would think of three scenarios. The pre-election scenario for Democrats was one of extreme exuberance, where they would have a good-sized majority in the Senate, a bigger majority in the House, and a Biden presidency. There was potential for a very aggressive agenda and all sorts of fronts to really get done. When they looked like they weren't going to have the Senate, it looked like it was going to be, you know, tough to do anything legislatively. Yes, Biden would be president. That's important. But what would get through Congress would be less. This is a very narrow majority in the Senate, 50-50, breaking the tie. It's a narrow majority in the House, and yet it is still a majority. And so there are certainly things that the Democrats can do using the budget process, essentially, and doing things which I think will be some of the earliest things related to COVID relief and economic relief. Being able to roll back some of Donald Trump's regulations, the last part of the administration's regulations, using some congressional procedures, and also on their nominations for cabinet positions or for some judges, they'll have a majority. Now, holding that 50-50 majority together and holding one senator from defecting is very difficult. And also, I don't believe that it's very likely that they're going to move against the filibuster, which was a thought early on, which would allow them to do many more things by a majority vote rather than by a 60-vote margin. And so, look, it's very good news for Democrats. They'll be able to do more. And with a new start and a new president and some momentum, they'll certainly have off the bat the ability to do some things that they would not have been able to do had the election gone the other way.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, your reaction to those Senate races in Georgia and the fact that the president-elect will probably be able to push through key parts of his agenda and certainly win confirmation of his cabinet selections as a result of this new 50-50 split, which, if there is a tie, it could be broken by, of course, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
I agree with all of John's analysis on the Georgia election. I'll just add one other thing. There is a civil war breaking out within the Republican Party, and ground zero of that civil war was Georgia. The president was chastising the governor of Georgia and the Georgia Secretary of State for their certification of Joe Biden's narrow victory there in November. And that definitely played into this election. And I don't think Democrats would have won had it not been for Donald Trump's behavior. Moving on to Joe Biden, what this means for Biden, this is a sea change. Like John said, it is a very narrow majority. The House majority for Democrats is the narrowest Democratic majority in the House since 1918. And the Senate majority is the narrowest majority possible. So it still means that nearly everything that gets done has to be done through the center ideologically. The Democratic caucus runs from the very far left in the Senate, Bernie Sanders, to someone who is arguably center-right, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. So I don't think this is a progressive wish list that you're going to see happening, but it does allow Biden to do a pretty aggressive agenda that reaches towards the center. And the main difference of this Georgia win is it allows Chuck Schumer, who is a Democrat and is now the new majority leader, it allows him to control the floor and the calendar rather than Mitch McConnell, a Republican who has been doing it for a long time, so that Joe Biden doesn't need essentially Mitch McConnell's permission to bring legislation to the floor. In some cases, as John pointed out, you just need a 51 vote margin using budget procedures, but a lot of times you're still going to need 60 votes as well.
Let's remind our listeners that you, Jim Kessler, used to work for Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, back in the day. And of course, he's probably extremely delighted about becoming majority leader. And as you said, that will enable him to set the agenda as well and help push through President-elect Biden's priorities, at least partially. Back to you, John Forte. I want to pick up on something that Jim Kessler said about a so-called civil war within the Republican Party. I'd like you to pick up on that and talk about what we're witnessing within the GOP, the grand old party, the Republican Party, given the rifts. What do you make of this, and what does it say about going forward for the party, what it stands for?
Well, first, just I think we should note in American politics generally, when a party loses the presidency, it is somewhat leaderless. We don't have an opposition leader, and there's often many voices in the party and really not a full voice for the Republican Party until they nominate somebody in 2024 for the presidency. There was always the question of Donald Trump and what his role would be. I do think that's going to be greatly diminished. I don't rule out that he's going to want to play a role and maybe try to get back into the politics, but it's going to be much harder. And I think the calculation for him and for voters will be much harder for him. I'm not sure if I think that Trumpism is going to disappear, or at least major parts of the way in which the Republican Party has shifted on issues towards more white working class issues. That's certainly was pushed forward by Donald Trump, but it even preceded Donald Trump, where the party was getting more and more votes from parts of the country that were industrial and, again, white working class, non-college educated whites. And so I think, you know, someone will take up that mantle, but partly because of the horrible events in the Capitol, you know, Donald Trump's ability to lead that might be certainly not as great and might not happen at all. And that would leave it more open. So I don't think we're going to see a return to sort of more left-wing or country club Republicanism, as some would call it, or even overly establishment Republicanism. But the field is wide open. And I think there will be some strands of Trumpism put in with different people in a different way. And there will be some fighting in the party. But there will also be a long time of leaderlessness until we really have that fight in the nomination process for president in 2024.
Jim Kessler, on our last program, both of you talked about some Republican moderates like Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney, of course, Utah, that they would potentially be voting on some issues with Democrats in the Senate. How do you see that possibility now?
That is going to be really interesting to watch going forward. I know Biden is going to try and reach out to mainstream Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, but particularly in the Senate. Now that Democrats have control of the floor, Schumer is in charge, there is certain legislation where you do not necessarily need any Republican support to win. So it is the necessity of having Republicans on your side in certain cases lessens. But I do think there's going to be a concerted effort. And I believe that there is a group of Republicans who actually want to see a successful Biden presidency rather than risking a return of Trump or Trumpism, that they're that concerned of what is going on. So this could be an interesting dynamic going forward in the next 2 years. I think Joe Biden is the right president to lead an effort that is reaching out to Republicans. You know, we'll see how the rest of congressional Democrats feel about it, but I think that that's a goal for Biden.
So back to you, John Fortier. I do want to make a statement about the composition of the House of Representatives. The Democrats did lose seats, and as Jim Kessler said, they have a very slim majority, but they are still in the majority. But I think we should tip our hats to Republicans, and particularly women. There are a lot of female Republicans who won seats. And some say that these women, you know, they may have a lot in common, you know, with other Democratic women, you know, centrist women. So it'll be interesting to see that dynamic. But let me ask you how you see the agenda going forward, you know, the legislative agenda for the 117th Congress.
Well, look, I think Democrats have an ambitious agenda that they'd like to take up. But, you know, we shouldn't forget that the main activity that is going on in this country really is still to deal with the pandemic and COVID and the economic consequences of that. And I do think that likely, partly because of the Senate rules, which allow things to be done by majority vote on things related to budget matters in certain ways, that we are likely to see some sort of relief package that is both addressed to dealing with COVID and dealing with the economy. And I think that's the most likely first vehicle that would get through. Now, Democrats have all sorts of other priorities, but some of those are more difficult in their own caucus, and some of them require 60 votes. And I'm not saying that there can't be compromises made and maybe more modest versions of those done. But I do think the first thing is going to be to turn to the COVID-19 crisis, both dealing with it itself and dealing with the economic consequences. And that's where I expect the Biden administration to begin.
You get the last word, Jim Kessler. Epidemiologists and public health experts have criticized the Trump administration for the slow rollout of vaccine distribution. They have certainly praised the Trump administration for Operation Warp Speed, which fast-tracked vaccine development. But there's been much criticism about the distribution of vaccines. And meantime, we've reached, that is the United States, a grim milestone of more than 4,000 deaths per day. So there's no question that COVID relief and mitigating the economic fallout will certainly be at the top of Joe Biden's agenda. So how do you think that's going to play out?
Yeah, that's for sure. Look, the Trump administration underestimated the impact of COVID-19, both in terms of health and the economy, from day one, referring to it as a cold and it will pass. And they've also underestimated the difficulty and the logistics required for getting the vaccine out. Basically, I'll just be charitable to them. Their philosophy on the pandemic and the vaccine has basically been, states, you figure it out, you do it. Clearly, you need a national strategy. The Biden administration is going to come in and really try and get this thing done and get it done right. And, you know, we're changing horses midstream. I have confidence that they'll make more of a concerted effort. And, you know, look, hopefully, you know, this will start moving forward and the vaccines will really move in earnest. But this slow start has been very disconcerting.
Gentlemen, that's about all the time we have on this edition. We look forward to seeing you very soon again. I'd like to thank my guest, John Fortier. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jim Kessler, executive vice president for policy at Third Way. Gentlemen, as always, thanks for a terrific conversation.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. She talks about President-elect Joe Biden's choice for education chief. Then Jonathan Evans brings us a story about backyard chickens. Armin Kasabian brings us a story about the influence of a non-traditional high school leader. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with the making of a nation. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
The United States will soon welcome Joe Biden as its new president. The president-elect has already named several people to serve in government leadership positions. For example, Janet Yellen is his candidate for Secretary of the Treasury, and General Lloyd Austin is his choice for Defense Secretary. Biden also named Miguel Cardona as the new Secretary of Education. The 45-year-old man currently serves as Education Chief for the state of Connecticut. Biden has called Cardona brilliant. Cardona grew up in government-supported housing in that state. His parents, who are from Puerto Rico, spoke Spanish to him. Cardona did not even speak English when he entered the public school system. Cardona started his career in education as a fourth-grade teacher. He became the top administrator, or principal, of a Connecticut public school at the young age of 28. He says his personal history has provided him a special understanding of the nation's educational inequalities. Cardona was appointed education chief in Connecticut just months before the COVID-19 crisis began last year. When schools moved to distance learning, he hurried to get more than 100,000 laptop computers to students across the state. Since then, however, he has increasingly urged schools to reopen, saying it is harmful to keep students at home. Cardona's first duty in his new job will be to help public schools across the U.S. safely reopen. Biden has promised to have a majority of U.S. schools reopened within his first 100 days in office. During the campaign, Biden also said he will work to get money to schools that are struggling. He plans to ask Cardona to help more young children get into preschool for free and to diversify the nation's teaching force. If the U.S. Senate confirms Cardona, he will replace Trump appointee Betsy DeVos in the position. Last week, the outgoing Secretary of Education wrote a letter to the U.S. Congress to say goodbye. In the letter, DeVos said the coronavirus crisis showed many things that are not encouraging about the U.S. education system. She also said she will continue to work for students even after her service as secretary is over. Biden has promised to withdraw or remake several of DeVos's policies. I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, here is Jonathan Evans.
Some chicken breeders and poultry groups say the coronavirus pandemic has led more people in the United States to start raising their own chickens. The practice provides people with a new interest, animal friendships, and a continuous supply of fresh eggs. Chicken keeping has become more popular in recent years as people seek ways to help the environment by carefully investigating the food they eat. Businesses that sell young chicks, coops, and other supplies say they have seen an increase in demand since last March. That is when U.S. health officials ordered people to stay home to help stop the spread of the coronavirus. Allison and Ron Abta live in Marin County, California. They had talked about setting up a chicken coop for years. They finally did so this summer. The couple's three children were excited when their parents finally agreed to buy chicks. "These chickens are like my favorite thing, honestly," said 12-year-old Violet. "They actually have personalities once you get to know them." The baby birds lived inside the family's home for 6 weeks before moving into their yard. A wire enclosure now houses the five hens and protects them from bobcats, foxes, and other animals that could harm them. Mark Podgwaite is a chicken breeder in Vermont who heads the American Poultry Association. He said he and other breeders have noticed an increase in demand for chicks since the pandemic began. His organization has also seen an increase in new members. "It just exploded. Whether folks wanted birds just for eggs or eggs and meat, it seemed to really, really take off," Podgwaite said. The Abta family bought their chicks from Mill Valley Chickens. The farming business sells chickens, feed, and supplies. It also builds coops. Owner Leslie Citron offers classes for first-time chicken keepers. She estimates her sales grew 400% in 2020. "I don't think it's going to slow down," Citron said. "I think this new interest and passion in chickens is permanent." Citron said most of her buyers in 2020 were first-time chicken keepers. Some of them are parents looking for something to keep their children busy while at home. Others are preppers, people who want their own supplies of things in case the world falls apart. "Demand is just through the roof right now," Citron said. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Next, we hear from Armin Kasabian.
Joe Clark was a non-traditional high school principal whose unusual way of enforcing rules became the subject of a 1989 Hollywood movie. Clark died late last year at the age of 82. He gained national attention for his leadership at Eastside High School in Paterson, New Jersey. "You are not inferior," is what Clark would often tell his students. Many of the Eastside students were African American or Latino. They grew up in a difficult environment. Many of the students who attended his school faced violence, crime, drugs, and troubled family life. Clark believed that students had to be shocked, often to understand the influences that could prevent them from succeeding in school and in life. In Clark's first days of working at Eastside High School, he expelled 300 students for fighting, destroying school property, abusing teachers, and drug possession. The students who remained at school believed that higher expectations were being placed on them. They felt more pressure to perform better. Before becoming an educator, Clark served in the U.S. Army Reserve. His experience might have influenced how he supervised his school. He was known to walk around with a bullhorn and a baseball bat. Some praised his efforts at discipline, while others criticized his methods. President Ronald Reagan offered Clark a White House policy advisor position after his success at the high school. In 1989, actor Morgan Freeman played Clark in the movie Lean on Me. That movie was based on Clark's experiences at Eastside High School. Joe was a father figure to school kids, Freeman said. He was the best of the best in terms of education. Not everyone supported his methods. One teacher who spoke to National Public Radio, or NPR, in 1988 said his methods were more like being in a labor camp than a public high school. NPR recently spoke to Thomas McIntyre, who said he was one of Joe Clark's former students. McIntyre said, "I never really got a chance to thank him. We are your product. You did not fail us. No matter if you kicked me out, you did not fail me. You bettered me," he said. After he retired from Eastside in 1989, Clark worked for 6 years as the director of a detention center for young people in Newark, New Jersey. He also wrote a book called Laying Down the Law, Joe Clark's Strategy for Saving Our Schools. He described how he managed to turn Eastside High from a failing school into a success. Clark was born in Rochelle, Georgia on May 8, 1938. His family moved north to Newark when he was 6 years old. I'm Armin Kasabian.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and sayings in American English. Today, we talk about fire. Any kind of fire, from a campfire to a lit match, gives off smoke. This fact about fire relates to today's idiom. There is no smoke without fire. Before we continue, let's talk about two words often used to explain this idiom, rumor and gossip. Rumors and gossip are stories or pieces of information that are passed from person to person, but have not been proven to be true. They are often about something bad. One meaning of there's no smoke without fire is that rumors and gossip often have some truth behind them. If the word on the street is that something is really bad, it just might be. Or if you hear unpleasant things about someone or something from many different people, there may be some truth to it. Maybe. Here's an example.
I think we should start looking for another job. I've heard that this bank is going under.
It could just be gossip.
But usually there's no smoke without fire.
In other words, there must be at least some truth to all the talk. The logic is this. If many people are saying that something bad is happening, it could be partly true. We say this idiom several ways. You can say, there's no smoke without fire. Or you can say, where there's smoke, there's fire. You can even simply say, where there's smoke, without continuing the rest of the sentence. People will definitely understand your meaning. Here is another example.
Hey, I hear you're going out with that new guy at work.
We just went for a long walk together. That's about it.
Well, be careful. Rumor has it that he is bad news.
What kind of bad news?
Well, he's been married before.
So, it's no crime to have a failed marriage.
Right. But he's been married 4 times. My cousin knows a former wife of his. She says the guy owes money all over town.
This is just gossip.
Look, I'm just saying be careful. Where there's smoke, yeah, you know.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The first 10 years of the 20th century in America were shaped by the strong leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. And in the second decade, he returned to national politics to bring once more dramatic changes to the United States. Theodore Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat who became president in 1933. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt organized a new political party, the Progressives. Roosevelt created this new party after he failed to win the Republican presidential nomination. The Republican Convention of 1912 had been controlled by conservative supporters of President William Howard Taft. And, as we hear now from Leo Scully and Morris Joyce, the party nominated Taft for 4 more years in the White House.
As a result, Roosevelt broke with the Republicans, and he and his supporters held their own convention. They formed the Progressive Party and approved a platform that promised reforms. These reforms were proposed to make the government serve the people and carry out more fully their desire for social progress. The Democratic Party also nominated a candidate who supported progressive ideas. The Democrats chose Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey, a former president of Princeton University. So, for the first time in many years, there were 3 major candidates for president. Wilson clearly had the best chance to win. He had the support of almost all the Democrats. The Republicans, however, were split. Some supported Taft, the others were for Roosevelt.
Roosevelt refused to accept the idea of defeat. He campaigned hard, visiting many cities and towns, making speech after speech. Wilson also campaigned hard. He seemed to enjoy it as much as Roosevelt. Taft did not like it at all. He refused to do much campaigning. He spent most of the time at his summer home. It was a quiet election campaign until the middle of October. Then, only 3 weeks before Election Day, Roosevelt was shot.
It happened in Milwaukee. Roosevelt had just left his hotel and climbed into the automobile that would carry him to the hall where he planned to make a speech. As he stood in the open car, an extremist named John Schrank ran up to him, pulled a gun from his coat, and fired a bullet into Roosevelt's chest. The bullet knocked him down. Roosevelt said it felt as if he had been kicked by a mule. He jumped up and put his hand to the wound. The bullet had passed through the inside pocket of his coat. It struck a steel case that held his glasses and went through the folded 50 pages of his written speech. These slowed the bullet, and it went only a few centimeters into his chest.
Roosevelt did not know if he was seriously wounded. He put his hand to his mouth and coughed. No blood came, and he knew the shot had not damaged his lungs. Roosevelt ordered the crowd around to stop beating Schrank. "Bring him to me," he said. He looked down at the man. "You poor creature," said Roosevelt. Then he turned away. Doctors arrived. They said Roosevelt must go at once to the hospital. But Roosevelt refused. He said he would go to the hall. "I will make this speech," he said, "or die. It will be one or the other." On his way to the hall, he told a friend, "It takes more than that to kill a Roosevelt. I do not care a rap about being shot, not a rap."
At the hall, he stood before the big crowd. His face was white, but he stood straight, without help. Someone announced that Roosevelt had been wounded, but still planned to speak. Roosevelt's voice was very low, almost a whisper. "I am going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. I'll do the best I can, but there is a bullet in me." He paused and then continued. "It is nothing. I am not hurt badly. I have something to say, and I will say it as long as there is life in my body."
Roosevelt's speech was not important. He said nothing that he had not already said many times before. What was important, however, was his cool courage. Men did not see his act as foolish or overly dramatic. They saw it as the brave act of a strong man. To the public, he was a hero. Roosevelt spoke for almost an hour. Finally, very weak, he let himself be helped from the hall. He was rushed to a hospital where doctors could examine the wound.
The doctors found that the bullet had broken a rib, but caused no serious damage. They decided to leave the bullet where it was. The next day, Roosevelt made a statement from his hospital bed. "Tell the people not to worry about me, for if I go down, another will take my place." President Taft and Woodrow Wilson sent messages of regret to Roosevelt. They announced that they would not campaign until Roosevelt was able to do so.
Roosevelt's condition improved quickly. After 2 weeks of rest, he was ready to continue his campaign for the presidency. He made a speech to a big crowd at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Everyone was surprised to see how strong and healthy he seemed. Wilson ended his campaign in New York City the next day. He told a cheering crowd of Democrats, "What the Democratic Party proposes to do is to go into power and do the things that the Republican Party has been talking about for 16 years.
On November 5th, the people voted. The winner was Woodrow Wilson. He received more than 6 million votes. Roosevelt was second with 4 million. Taft received only about 3.5 million. Wilson's victory was even greater in the electoral vote. He got 435. Roosevelt got only 88. And Taft received only the 8 electoral votes of Utah and Vermont. The Democrats won not only the White House, but also control of Congress. And a number of Democratic governors were elected in states formerly controlled by Republicans.
The 1912 campaign ended public life for Theodore Roosevelt. Soon after the election, a friend visited Roosevelt and talked of possible victory in 1916. "I thought you were a better politician," Roosevelt said. "The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do. That is to go back to the Republican Party. You cannot hold a party like the Progressive Party together. There are no loaves and fishes, no financial support."
War was soon to break out in Europe. The United States would enter the struggle in 1917. As always, Roosevelt was ready to join in a fight. He asked for permission to organize an American force and lead it into battle in France. President Wilson, however, turned down the request. Roosevelt was sure that it was a political decision. He never forgave Wilson for keeping him out of the war. Although Roosevelt himself could not fight, 4 of his sons went into battle. One, his youngest son, Quentin, did not return. And when he received news of his son's death, Roosevelt wrote these words to honor him:
"Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die. And none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. All of us who give service and stand ready for sacrifice are torchbearers. We run with the torches until we fall, satisfied if we can then pass them to the hands of other runners. The torches whose flame is brightest are carried by the brave men on the battlefield and by the brave women whose husbands, lovers, sons, and brothers struggle there. These are the torchbearers. These are they who have dared the great adventure."
Roosevelt's own great adventure was itself coming to an end. He suffered from painful attacks of inflammatory rheumatism and from a serious ear infection. He had difficulty in hearing and could not walk. But the old man was still cheerful. He spent his 60th birthday in the hospital. And to his family and friends, he said, "I am ahead of the game. Nobody ever packed more kinds of fun and interest into 60 years. Death came to Roosevelt as he slept on the night of January 6th, 1919. Said Vice President Thomas Marshall, "Death had to take him sleeping, for if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight."
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.